Hello and welcome to Always Take Notes.
We wanted to draw your attention to our crowdfunding page on Patreon. If you've been enjoying Always Take Notes, please do consider supporting us there. It helps us to keep the podcast going.
If you support us on Patreon, you can get a great selection of rewards, including a shout out on the show and a selection of successful magazine pictures.
If you pledge $10 a month, you also get a free 2-month trial to Otter, worth $26, alongside the other rewards. Otter offers automated transcription and live note-taking for in-person and virtual meetings. I found it to be a huge help when organising interview material.
Thanks again for supporting Always Take Notes.
Hello and welcome to Always Take Notes. In this episode, we speak to Fraser Nelson, the editor of The Spectator.
We spoke to Fraser about the process of running a weekly magazine, his earlier career at The Times and The Scotsman, and about adapting a print title to the digital age.
It's a great episode. We hope you enjoy it. Welcome, Fraser, to Always Take Notes. Thank you very much for making the time to speak to us. I wondered if I could start with a very basic question. What does the editor-in-chief of The Spectator do? What's your daily routine like?
The editor is responsible for everything and nothing. That is the phrase. So if I'm doing my job properly, I shouldn't be a cog in the machine. It's my job to make sure that the machine works. So I actually think of it more as an ecosystem. Like, The Spectator is an incredible collection of writers, sub-editors, journalists, producers. It's a kind of magic, and I'm here to try to make sure that magic continues. Now, that mainly expresses itself in things like, obviously, who I hire is the most important thing. If you want to look at sort of the top 20 things that have happened to The Spectator under my editorship, I wasn't responsible for any of them. They were all other people. But I do credit myself with hiring those other people and getting out of their way so they're able to make sparks fly. Now, of course, I read copy, I write, I edit probably a bit too much. I'm quite an active editor. And I will I'll contribute to the commissioning of ideas. But the other thing which I think the editor does now, especially for a modern magazine, one which has, The Spectator, of course, we're known as a print magazine, but we've also got podcasts, emails, a website, television. It's to ensure this kind of consistency, that it all looks like it's cut from the same kind of cloth, that you, when you listen to a Spectator podcast, it should feel like an extension of the magazine, that when you look at our email, in the lunchtime email of the newsy bulletin, it's still there's something spectatory about that. So you don't want these sort of digital products, to use a very boring word, to take on a life or identity of their own. You need to make sure they've all got the Spectator's identity. Now, this changes a lot from when I first became editor, almost exactly 13 years ago. I mean, then my job was simply to look after the magazine, as it was for generations of Spectator editors before me. Since then, my job has changed utterly. And I would say it's now mainly about ensuring the consistency of voice across everything we do and just looking after the our quite small, only 35 journalists we've got in total here at The Spectator. And it's my job to make sure that ship keeps sailing.
Could you tell us how your routine works on a daily and a weekly basis? How does...
Pick a day and I'll tell you. It changes every day.
Monday.
Monday is a bit of a stressful day, right? Typically, my Monday starts on Sunday evening because we need to plant the seeds for commissioning things on Monday. The seeds will take about a day or two to grow, so the copy comes in Tuesday afternoon to Wednesday morning. We should have about half to three quarters of it commissioned by Monday. Monday is last chance. So on Monday, I've got to read extensively and make a big decision as editor. What are people going to want to read on the next Saturday? We get a press on the Wednesday, but the Saturday is when it's dated. So if you wake up on a Monday too influenced by what happened in the Sunday newspapers, that can be a mistake because that can seem old news by the Thursday and Friday. Almost never does whatever dominated the news on Sunday go on to dominate the news the next Saturday. So I would have to do a lot of reading, making some phone calls, talk to my friends. Typically, my Monday would start at 5:30, 6 in the morning. I'd do a blast of work for about a couple of hours. And then it's showtime, family time. Kids come downstairs, we get them breakfast, off to school, etc. And then I'll go in and we'll have our conference at 10:30. Our conference is pretty free-flowing. It's actually quite scary sometimes because we walk into that conference having no idea what the cover's going to be and hoping that something's going to come magically from the conversation that we go on to have for the next hour and a half. So we sell, we serve croissants, coffee, throw ideas about, and have a talk amongst ourselves. And then we try to find out what topic catches our conversation the most, what we collectively find to be the most interesting. So nobody really pitches a formal idea for the cover. We just might mention a couple of themes, we'll discuss it between us, and it's a bit organic to see if something grows or doesn't grow. So the most important thing there is to find the cover story, and then the cover illustration. We'll try to think of a few ideas, because the spectator, of course, the most important thing is the cover, the illustration, and if you can depict it. And some articles or themes are very, very hard to depict. Others lend themselves more easily to it. So you can't really walk out of the room with an idea, but no picture. You need both the idea and the picture. Now, once we do that, say we finish at about 11:30, or sometimes 12 o'clock, then we will start calling people, commissioning, or I might go straight into other meetings. There's a lot of managerial meetings. The Spectator is a very fast-growing magazine. Today, for example, I've spent probably all 5 hours before meeting you discussing the problems we're having with login technology, password users who forget their logins, how you remember it. I can't tell you how boring the subject is, but I can't tell you how important the subject is for the future of magazines. If you're buying a publication that keeps asking for your login, if it keeps kicking you out, you're not going to keep paying for that thing. You're going to give up on the next month. And this is the sort of flaw, really, in our industry, us writers. When a writer like me becomes an editor, I become a manager. Now, the writing temperament is quite different to the managerial temperament. The managerial temperament is to talk about things like KPIs, to think about the software problems that might lead to this, that, or the other. These things can quite easily bore a writer. And that is where publishers can sometimes come unstuck. Because right now we're living through an industrial revolution in journalism, in digital, in how people consume their writing. And we're also, to my annoyance, but it's undeniably true, editors like me are living in an era where we are judged by our readers 50-50 on the tech and the content. So if you're reading us on an app, 3/4 of digital subscribers typically read an app. That app's got to work. It's got to be good. It's got to be intuitive. So a great deal of my time on a Monday, because after we do the commissioning bit, is then towards the tech, the managerial side. It's towards thinking of those kind of things. I might also, if I'm doing my job properly, I should be looking at the lunchtime email. That's huge for us. It goes to something like 130,000 people. We've only got 110,000 subscribers. And the open rate is absolutely huge. So something like 1/4 of our entire readers of the weekly magazine are going to open that podcast, sort of that email on a Monday, and judge us in part by what they see. So I've got to make sure that's consistent. Then I talk to the online team to see if what they've served up on the website is right, if we think it's presented right. And then I might have time for a bit of journalism myself. By journalism, I mean reading, talking to people. I'm a political journalist, so I still have a column for the Daily Telegraph. So a large part of my job is trying to find out what's happening in the rest of the world. And then I'm talking to you right now from the editor's office, which is a beautiful room. I'm sitting here on a desk which used to belong to Nigel Lawson, beside a sofa that used to belong to Boris Johnson. And, you know, it's a beautiful room. I'm never in this room. I'm always sitting next to colleagues in some other department, whether it be podcast, magazine, tech, production, or whatever, trying my best to do what I can to help them get along. So I always take the Kelvin McKenzie view that the editor's office is the last place you should expect to find a good editor.
You mentioned the consistency of voice and output. For any listeners who aren't familiar with The Spectator, could you give us a brief history of the publication and how it's evolved into the modern day?
Well, the first ever Spectator came out in 1711. It was a daily op-ed, the first of its sort in the world. It was published on one sheet of paper, 2 sides, and the op-eds would write about everything from politics, culture, manners, economics, foreign affairs. It would take as much interest in literature and poetry as it would in what was going on in courts and parliament. We'd have space for Latin, and it was famous. When I say famous, it wasn't famous at the time because it only sold 2,000 copies. It came to an end the year after in 1712. But what happened then was that Sam Buckley, the guy who produced it, this genius who had the tech to serve up a daily op-ed sheet to the coffee houses of 1711 London, he then bought the copyright. I mean, he sold every... He put all the essays together, 550 of them, and sold them in a seven-volume set. That seven-volume set went on to become one of the greatest bestsellers in the world. Even a century and a half later, in 1828, The Spectator, that seven-volume set, was to be found in almost every educated household in Britain, sometimes in France as well. Benjamin Franklin says that he learnt to give speeches based on The Spectator he's reading then. Now, this matters because a Scot, a Dundonian called Stephen Rintoul, set it up again as a weekly in 1828. So he kind of figured, and quite right too, that if everybody was still having in their house this Spectator, which was written 120 years ago, then why not revive it as a weekly? Now, we are the oldest weekly in the world, dated back not to 1711, but to 1828. Initially, we were set up for the 1832 Reform Act, but we've come out weekly ever since. So we do politics, arts, and that incredible consistency. As editor, when I'm thinking about our digital expansion, you know, the blogs, the emails, everything, I like to think we're sampling the DNA of the Addison Spectator. He was the first editor, Joseph Addison, in 1711. So I collect these old copies. I've got them in my room. I've got every single one of the originals at home as well. And I read them quite regularly. And I try to work out the kind of the vibe, what were they trying to achieve? What they were trying to do, those guys, and this is basically what The Spectator is, they were trying to show you can have disagreements, but you can have them civilly. You don't have to hate each other. In a time of culture wars now, or civil war back in those days, you can still have people who fundamentally see the world differently, but through the medium of humour and intelligence, you can agree to disagree. Number two, that you take the arts and the books as seriously, if not more seriously, than everything else. So we have a little ancient and modern column where we talk about the greats, the classics, the ancient world, and we've kept that going consistently. And then there is the tone. We sort of reject the rather pompous, learned, I'm very clever, de ho and ba tone that you get in quite a lot of op-ed writing. Our writing has to be good. Fundamentally, we're about good quality writing. People quite often regard us as a conservative magazine, but that simply isn't true. We are not. I mean, there isn't a constituency, for example, in this country, let alone the world, for a conservative party magazine. And sure, we lean to the right, but we do way more articles about books than we do about politics in every issue of The Spectator. So we, but our style is, our commitment is to good writing. I've got this sort of long list I give to new people who join us, and I try to, the most important part of that is to tell them what is The Spectator. And The Spectator is devoted to originality of thought, elegance of expression, independence of opinion. Those are our principles. And we will publish everything from people from left to right, but what we do have a bias towards is minority views. We like to show readers arguments they will not have heard before, arguments they probably won't agree with. Usually in every magazine there's at least two articles I disagree with so much that I'd rather they weren't published at all. But then again, I'm the last person in London who should be taking a censor's pen to these things, because we offer a range of argument wider than you're going to get elsewhere. And take the view that if you disagree with it, then you don't mind reading things you disagree with. That's very much The Spectator's vibe. So that's what we try to do with a magazine, and we do as best we can to replicate that in the other, in our broadcast videos and digital elements.
You alluded to this in your answer there, but how does the magazine's relationship and interaction with the Conservative Party work? I mean, the fact that, you know, Boris Johnson, the last British Prime Minister, was a former editor of The Spectator, Dominic Cummings' wife works there. It's often remarked by outsiders that there's this very close relationship between the Westminster Tory Party and the magazine. How do you see it from where you sit?
The New York Times once described us as being in bed with the government, but still pulling off the bedsheets as well. And that's the way I like to see it. If you really want to know what's happening inside this government, there is nowhere better than The Spectator to find out. Now, that's a relatively small part of what we do, but what we do it very well. My colleagues James Forsyth, Katie Balls, Isabel Hardman, you will not find any better informed political journalists than these three. So this is quite strange for a small magazine like ours with only 35 journalists to have three out of our sort of five staff writers are political specialists. That's quite a lot. But they do it better than anybody else. Now, our relationship with the Conservative Party, it varies, really. We support them when they do things that we like. We criticise them when they don't. We didn't back a candidate in this leadership contest, for example. We didn't think Liz Truss quite deserved our support. And I'm afraid to say, when Boris Johnson, our former editor, when he started to start enacting everything he opposed when he was a journalist, we gave him both barrels. I think I wrote a couple of cover stories pointing out how far he'd gone from his principles. I don't believe in endorsements, pretty much. I don't think publications should be telling readers to vote this way or vote that way. Other publications did endorse Liz Truss or Rishi Sunak. We didn't do that. I think our job is to scrutinise these guys and to do as best we can to take readers behind the scenes and let them know what's being said behind closed doors. But our principles are classic liberal principles. They're not really conservative. The magazine believes in diversity of opinion. These are classic liberal objectives. So I don't think you could say that we look at everything from a conservative viewpoint. We've got people like Nick Cohen, who's a committed Labour Party supporter. I think we've got Rod Little, who's been kicked out of the Labour Party. I think he offended them by something he wrote. But my point is that we get people whose politics range from left to right, their circumstances from high life to low life. We like to think that we give you a better analysis of a Conservative Party than anybody else, but we are not an organ of that party, nor we don't shill for it. We simply do our journalistic job.
Various outlets have observed that you have doubled circulation since being editor. It's now more than 100,000 people. I noticed there's been a particular uptick since 2015. Have you benefited from Brexit, Trump, various other geopolitical movements?
It's interesting. You're right in saying I became editor in 2009, and at the time sales were tanking. And I wanted to revive them, but for a long time, until about 2015, nothing. We seemed to stem the decline, but it was stagnation, and it was agonising. And it was quite demoralising for me. I felt as if I wasn't really making much difference as editor, and that I should probably make way for somebody who could improve the sales. I always passionately believed that The Spectator had the potential to double, treble, quadruple its sales, even though the magazine market has gone down by two-thirds since I became editor. I still felt that we could reach, and by the way, I still feel that. I don't feel particularly successful. I think our sales should be way higher than they are. But as to what happened in 2015-16, it's certainly right that what I would regard as the crazy era of politics started probably at the Scottish referendum. That was when things started going absolutely wild, when the Nationalists came within a hair's breadth of victory. And then after that, Cameron got his majority, really unexpectedly, in 2015. Then you had the Brexit vote. And then you ended up with a really high volume of really unlikely, implausible, crazy political things. But the difference, I think, and I've got data that I won't bore you about to make the point, the difference was that by then, the digital products we'd come out with, that our podcasts, our blogs, they had started to pick up an audience. And we had started through those digital means to reach an audience that we'd never reached before via the newsstand and the newsagents. So all of a sudden, The Spectator became a magazine that was only really read or referred to by its subscribers and those who might pick it up in the newsagent, to something that was read by hundreds of thousands of people online, that a podcast that was listened to tens of thousands of people through their headphones. We just found different ways of reaching people, and that, roundabout the middle of the last decade, started to convert into greater sales. So digital kind of saved print, as it were. Our print sales are also at a record high. But that's because of the, I would put it down to a combination, certainly, of a kind of avalanche of news events. So your average person just felt they needed to be across politics a bit more. That would help us. But because politics is less than a quarter of what we do in The Spectator, it didn't help us that much. But it was more the digitization and the expansion of the brand through digital spheres that I think helped take ourselves from where they were to where they are.
We want to come back to the Contemporary Spectator in due course, but can we roll back now to your early life and your initial interest in journalism and writing? Is it right that you sort of fell in love with it while studying history at Glasgow?
Yes, it is. I fell in love with it, but it was an unrequited love, as it were, that I didn't think I was very good at writing. And by the way, I still don't particularly. I mean, you can love things you're not great at. You can love art even if you can't paint. I loved literature. I loved journalism. I never really felt it was my vocation. When I started out, I did a whole bunch of things. I, like, first of all, thought I would follow my dad into the military. And I went for RAF tests, and luckily for our national security, I failed those tests. I then thought I'd be a piano player. I played bars in Glasgow, and for a while I thought that was what I was going to do with my life. I managed to get a pretty good hourly rate. And it was, I sort of regarded that as being my gift, if you like. Like, the one thing that I thought I could do better than other people was play the piano. I didn't think I could write better or study better. I was never a particularly good student. I didn't particularly excel at everything, but I excelled at piano. But then I found out, as a lot of would-be musicians do, that if you want to make a living out of it, you need to be just so good. We're talking of a top 0.01%, and even then it's difficult to make a living. So I was a bit naive about the prospects of being able to make it as a musician. But then I got involved in a student newspaper at Glasgow, and that's when I really fell in love. It wasn't so much with the writing, it was just the business of putting through a paper together, the romance of it, the teamwork, the company of journalists. It's still the greatest thrill, the greatest joy of my life, not just my job, is the company of my colleagues here in 22 Old Queen Street. It's something. There's something about it, the camaraderie, the creative process, which I fell completely in love with and I'm still completely in love with. And that is what drives me, I suppose, as an editor. Now, I mean, I am also, I was a political writer before I became an editor. It was never obvious to me at all that I had it in me to become an editor, a manager. When I was offered this job, I thought Andrew Neil was absolutely mad to offer it to me. I thought I would last about a few months and he'd fire me. But then I guess I worked out that when you're writing, there is a sort of, it's a multiplying factor. The way I see it, some people are born naturally gifted writers. Charles Moore has probably never written a bad sentence. The same is true, weirdly, with Rod Little. He was a broadcaster, but it's just incredible. You see how fast he turns around a copy. Incredibly gifted. Douglas Murray, the same as that. Now, I am not like that, but you don't have to be an effective journalist. To be an effective journalist, you can try to come up with information, talk to people, find out new things, find out what's being said under the scene. The investigative aspect to it, the research aspect to it, that's something which I think I'm comparatively good at. So when it comes to me as a writer, I don't say, I would love to think that one day somebody will make a book out of my columns, but I don't particularly think so. Those are the kind of, you know, you do find books of columnists. Danny Finkelstein's done one as well. And those are people whose words, whose writing is of such high quality that it's incredibly beautiful to read years after the event. I've got, I don't know how many books at home of those sort of columnists. My journalism is rather less lofty. I simply try to tell people what's happening behind closed doors. I try to make an original point that might help them deceive things in a different way. I like to think that my own writing is useful to people as they try to make sense of the world around them. So as a writer, I would say that I'm more of a journalist than a writer, if that makes sense. I think everybody has got a mixture, and I'm lucky enough to work with, I've always hero-worshipped writers. Well, one of the funny things in my job is I meet lots of famous people, as you would do if you're a journalist, and none of that particularly excites me. But to meet a good writer, that's when I go weak at the knees. I've got all of my, and I try to abuse my position sometimes and just try to meet hero writers. And quite often ask them how they do it, as if there's some great secret they're going to pass on to me that I could somehow replicate and digest and improve my own writing. But the funny thing is, when I've spoken to great writers, the bottom line is they're born with it, in my view. You can improve, of course, anybody can improve. But I would say that I'm a constructed rather than a natural writer, more noted for my enthusiasm than my ability.
Could you tell us a little bit about your path after university, from studying journalism as a postgraduate at City to then working at The Times?
Yeah, well, I got into City, probably one of the biggest breaks of my life, getting into that course. It's a very coveted postgraduate diploma, as it was in those days. I'm sure they call it a master's now or something. And when you're there, it means you get far better chance of getting work experience, and work experience is the gateway to getting into journalism. It's a very close... The work experience route is incredibly guarded. When I was there, I was just amazed at how nepotistic it was. Every time I ended up in work experience, I found out I'd be there with a daughter or the niece or the friend of somebody else who worked on the staff. And it made me realise just what a closed shop journalism is. And I hated that about journalism. I still think that's one of our profession's biggest defects. Just what an old boys club we really are. I'll give you an example of that. We've got... one of my colleagues, Svetlana Mornets, she's a Ukrainian refugee, and she came to us through our internship scheme. By the way, partly because of my own experience, I did our internship scheme very differently. We do a CV-blind, name-blind internship scheme. So we open it to everybody. When they apply, we take away their names. We give them a city name like Tokyo or Madrid, so we can't even see if the person's got a foreign or a domestic name. We only look at ability. And we take in the top 12. We get about 200 applicants. That's how we hire at The Spectator. I'm lucky enough to work with a whole bunch of people who come in via that way. And a very diverse group of people as well. More diverse than you would get via the old boys network, which is still all too pervasive through work experience. Anyway, my point here is that when we took one of them, I think the name was Barcelona. And I found to my surprise that Barcelona was a Ukrainian refugee who happened to be an award-winning journalist who was displaced by the war. And she'd been to the job centre, and she was told in the job centre that you won't get a job here as journalists because foreigners aren't employed as journalists in this country. Now, that's quite something. You know, immigrants are 20% of the workforce. But she was told, if you're an immigrant, no, journalism doesn't take in immigrants. Now, my first reaction was to think, God, that's a terrible thing to say about writing. Why are we saying that immigrants can't be journalists? But then I started to look around newspapers and try to work out how many do I know who are actually immigrants? And it's almost none. So that is something about journalism. For some reason, we are, 20% of the workforce is immigrants, probably 0.2% of journalists are immigrants. And this is a bit of a diversion, but suffice to say that I was quite scarred by my own attempts to get into journalism. I got into the city school, but trying to get into newspapers I found very, very difficult if you're from a background like mine, if you don't know anybody, if you're not familiar with the world, if you've got no contacts. It remains very difficult to break into journalism unless you apply to the Spectator's trainee scheme. So I did that. I was lucky enough to get a job at the Times where I did shifts. But now I went in as a financial and economics journalist, and that was quite good fun because I'm quite into numbers. I used to do the first thing I ever submitted for publication wasn't an essay, but it was a computer program. I used to be a coder, so I quite liked financial journalism. I still do love numbers and graphs. It's a little bit of a hobby of mine. And then I did a few years at the Times business desk, and then they needed somebody to go up to Scotland to be a Scottish political correspondent. They hadn't filled the vacancy, and the managing editor heard me in the toilets talking with a Scottish accent. And he was like, "Oh, right, Jock, what do you fancy going up to Edinburgh?" And it was so random. You know, journalism is like that, these random job opportunities. The way I think about journalism is like you're a monkey trying to make your way through the jungle, and a vine comes swimming towards you, and you've got no idea where the vine is going to go, but your only choice is, do you jump on the vine or not as it swings by? And if you do jump on it, you've no idea where you're going next. So I decided to jump on that vine. I left financial journalism. By the time I was doing retail and fashion journalism, which I loved, to be honest, loved it a bit too much, but I ended up doing political journalism in Edinburgh for a year, which I really hated, despite being Scottish. And then I joined The Scotsman to get back to London, ironically, as their political editor. The Scotsman was owned by the Barclay brothers, and when they bought The Spectator and sold The Scotsman, I was one of about three or four journalists transferred from The Scotsman to The Spectator. I started off there as a dog's body in 2006 and became editor in 2009.
Hello, it's Artemis, the producer of Always Take Notes. I hope you're enjoying Simon and Rachel's conversation with Fraser Nelson, the editor of The Spectator. It's time for the next instalment of our Midway segment where we share bonus material from previous guests of the show. So this week we're going to hear from the children's author and illustrator, Lauren Child, and she's going to tell you about a time in her career she failed.
I've failed many times in my writing career and my illustration career as well. But I think what I learned from that is when to listen, when is useful what the critic is saying to you, whether the critic be an editor or somebody else, and when actually you just have to wait and sit on it until you feel there's a time when that piece of writing will, you know, will have value. Sometimes it doesn't ever, but they're right about it, but sometimes they're not.
That was Lauren Child. And if you're interested in what Lauren had to say, you can listen to our full interview with her via our website, which is www.alwaystakenotes.com. But for now, back to Simon and Rachel's conversation with Fraser Nelson.
Could you tell us about your relationship with Andrew Neil, who seems to have been a kind of key figure for you? When did you meet him first, and how has that relationship worked throughout your career, and how does it work? And we saw this quote that you've been described as the longest surviving editor to work under Andrew.
Yeah, I first met Andrew Neil when he was doing a BBC radio show called Down Your Way. That's when they take it back to his... You know, he came in, so we took him back to Glasgow. He was the editor of the Glasgow University student newspaper, as I was. So the BBC put us together. So Andrew would have been, probably in his late 40s. I would have been a student, 20 or so. And that's when I first met him. And I interviewed him for the student newspaper. But I didn't have any contact with him after that. And then I met him again, we're talking 10 years later, when I was Scottish political correspondent of the Times. I met him at a party and I got talking to him. And that obviously changed my life. I keep telling my younger colleagues about why you should go to these parties if you're a journalist. I mean, not because you'll enjoy yourself, but there's a 1 in 4 chance that you'll meet somebody useful. And there's a 1 in 100 chance, perhaps 1 in 200 chance, that you'll meet somebody who will change your life. And that's why it's so important, especially in the digital world, for journalists to go out there, talk to people, meet people, go and, you know, drink warm white wine at a party on the off chance you might meet somebody who might introduce you to something else. Now, when I got talking to Andrew, he and I hit it off. He didn't remember me from the first time that we'd met. And then he asked me to leave the Times and join the Scotsman, where he was then editor-in-chief. That was quite a big move, to leave national and join a local. But at the time, the Times, which I loved, didn't particularly love me. They kept calling me Fergus, not Fraser. And I always took that as a sign that my career wasn't really going anywhere. They couldn't even get my name right. My news editor at the time was Michael Gove as well. And so I thought, you know, the Times is fun, but really, if they can't get my name right, I'm not going anywhere there, realistically. So why didn't I accept this flattering offer from Andrew Neil? So I went down to London to be Westminster editor, later political editor for Andrew. I'm a Scotsman, and Ian Martin, my then editor. He also invited me to be a jointly editor of the Scotsman and The Business, this Sunday newspaper he had at the time. Now, Andrew is a great one for making huge results out of tiny resources. The Business had no resources at all. Andrew and I would write, quite often we would work together on a leading article. So then I got to work with them journalistically, and we struck up an effective journalistic relationship. And I think Andrew was probably instrumental when the Barclay sold the Scotsman in saying, no, I want to keep Fraser Nelson, Alistair Heath, Ian Martin. We were the three that were evacuated into the new group. And I will, for the rest of my life, owe a huge debt to Andrew Neil, because he saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. He saw in me somebody who could be editor of a Spectator. I absolutely did not see that person. And looking back, I think I'm big-headed enough to say that he was right. I could do it. I did do it. I like to think I've repaid the faith he's shown in me. But it was faith in his part rather than mine. I wasn't banging down his door suggesting that I become editor. When he offered me the job, he invited me down to his house in France for the weekend, which I thought was unusual but quite nice. And I just couldn't quite believe, A, that he offered it to me, and nor could I believe I was saying yes to him, because I hadn't thought about it, hadn't discussed it with my wife. And previously I thought to myself, if I was offered the job, I would turn it down, because I want to be a writer, I don't want to be an editor. I don't think I'm a very good manager, I've never written a headline, I'll just stick to writing. But something else happened that evening when he offered me the job. I thought to myself, if I turn it down now, I'll spend the rest of my life regretting that I had turned down a job. Let's not deny it's one of the best jobs in London. Boris Johnson called it the best job in London. I didn't think I could do it, but then again, was I going to turn it down? I thought I owed it to myself to say yes. And since then, he's been a very laissez-faire publisher. And I have probably edited 600 issues of The Spectator. Not one single issue have I had a scintilla of interference from Andrew. Now, that is pretty hard to imagine if you know how passionate Andrew is, what an engaged writer he is. The most he's ever asked me is, what's the cover this week? That's it. He's never said, do this, don't do that. Now and again, he might say he enjoyed this article, he didn't enjoy that. If he finds an error, I think a few days ago he found a typo in one of the blogs that we'd written. So he would send me an email, you know, quite rightly saying, typo, change it, please. But I could not ask for more editorial freedom than I get from Andrew. And the same is true for our proprietors, the Barclay brothers. They are, the Barclay family, should I say. And I'll give you an example of the freedom which they offer. When it came to which way we were going to go in Brexit, which is a bigger decision as you can make for a publication, they called me in. They very seldom call me in. They asked me which way we were going to go. They didn't give me, I had no indication on the way in what the right answer was, what they prefer. And they asked me, had we prepared the way for that? It was a big decision, but there was I found it later, but they were quite happy, luckily for me, that we did back Brexit. For me as a Remainer, it was a former Remainer, it was a very difficult decision. But I suggest that there probably is not an editor in Britain, perhaps not in Europe, who's got more editorial freedom than that which I have been given by Andrew and by the Barclay family. So I think whatever goes wrong with The Spectator, it is 100% on my head.
To remain in the past briefly, when you joined The Spectator in 2006, am I right in thinking that Boris Johnson was no longer editor at that point?
Yes, it was. There was a strange interregnum. He had gone, Matthew Nakuna hadn't quite arrived, and Stuart Reed was the acting editor. So I was appointed in a sort of rather undefined position during the interregnum.
And what was the legacy of the sex data scandals at that point?
It was record sales, fantastic reputation. Boris could not have done a better job marketing The Spectator. This kind of Merry England conservatism which he embodied was brilliant. Scandal after scandal after scandal. And people loved it. And our sales absolutely shot up. I'd absolutely no idea how, as a happily married Orthodox Catholic, I was going to replicate the success of Boris Johnson. Okay, admittedly rather unorthodox techniques. But if you want to capture people's attention, my God, it wasn't just Boris, though. And Rod Little did his bit as well. And as did Kimberly Quinn, our then publisher, who had an affair with a former Home Secretary. You know, the whole Spectator's team, it was quite a squad in those days. Inspiring this West End play called Who's the Daddy, written by Toby Young, one of our writers, and Lloyd Evans, our theatre critic. So yes, it did have quite a reputation. One that I was horribly aware when I became editor that I would struggle to maintain. But I like to think that we've done okay using slightly more orthodox marketing techniques.
You said that it's not a culture war fighting right-wing magazine, but another comment that you'd made was that the woke virus has been great for our sales because it gives young people who can't abide all this an appetite to read material they're not going to get elsewhere. Could you unpack at that a little bit? Because it seems that that is in some ways a sort of admission that you kind of are participating in and profiting from the culture wars.
We profit from them because people get sick of them. And when they get sick of them, they come to us. Now, right now, you do not get very, very many sort of young conservatives, shall we say. Like, when you go to university, sure, you're going to find young conservatives. They tend to be in a very different wavelength to the rest of their generation. That it's not a particularly big constituency. But there's a far bigger constituency of young people, the ones who don't entirely go along with identity politics, with the use of pronouns, with the decolonisation of the curriculum. Not that they wander around in a rage with this, but they sort of see a consensus, a rather imposed with an air of authoritarianism, and they think, hang on, where's this is all a bit much. What about those who disagree? What about the other way of looking at things? Now, that has led to, for young people, when they come in to a spectator, that they will find a respite from all of that. We do what we've always done, but what we don't do is homogenise opinion. We will, we're quite satirical, we're quite heretical, we like to slay sacred cows. We have always have done that. If you pick up The Spectator of 1711, The Spectator of 1828, we've always done that. But right now that's a little bit more rare, and it stands in greater contrast to what you typically get on a university campus. So that has made us, even though we haven't changed, it has made us stand out a little bit more on for younger people, and who come to us simply wanting the range of debate, which they feel is almost underground in its nature, because it can be so difficult to talk about subjects like, I don't know, there's a whole bunch of subjects that's very difficult to talk to without getting into sort of hysterical territory very quickly. And we try to have rational conversations about that kind of thing. Now, going back to this document that I keep updating for my younger staff who join, about what is The Spectator, one of the things it's very easy to mistake us for, and one of the things that is absolutely crucial that any of my younger colleagues realises when they join, is that we are not the mirror image of the woke people. We are not anti-woke, as it were. That whole culture wars phenomenon is something that we define ourselves against. We do not want to troll the libs or anything like that. There is a brand of journalism. Breitbart do it. You'll get some other... A lot of people do it on Twitter, where it is basically... it's Looney Tunes stuff, where you'll promote conspiracy theories and use ridiculous language and define and start, you know, there's a whole list of right-wing cliches, which I've got a list of, for example, 15 right-wing cliches I don't want people to use in our magazine. Now, not that my staff colleagues would use them, but we rely on a lot on freelance contributors. Now, if we get a freelance contributor who spends his time on Twitter, which a lot of people do, unfortunately, you can get Twitter derangement syndrome, where you start to write a thing about Owen Jones says this and isn't this terrible, etc. And we almost ban mention of people like Owen Jones and Katie Hopkins and these sort of, you know, the digital controversialists who try to get a reaction out of people. That is not what we do. So in other words, if you want to start criticising fringe opinion that you see on Twitter, then you become part of Twitter's moronic inferno. Twitter, when you switch it on, is inviting you as a user, saying, look at this, Fraser, look at this, Simon, look at this ridiculous thing somebody said. Wouldn't you love to comment on it? Wouldn't you love to not let him get away with it? But the moment that you accept Twitter's invitation and start an argument like that, you're accepting its hand in the dance of foolishness, moronness. I'm not quite sure what the word is for it. But it's something which we define ourselves against as a publication. People spend a lot of time in social media. We get about a quarter of our traffic from social media, so we need to be careful there. I always tell my colleagues it's like observing what Star Trek called the Prime Directive, how you can visit foreign planets but never interfere with the lives of the natives. So you can go on Twitter, but don't become off Twitter. Don't pick arguments with people. Don't QT people. So when it comes to culture wars, I think the sheer low quality of a debate has whetted an appetite for a higher quality of writing, more rational analysis, and a greater variety of views. And that is our entree to a new generation of people who might not be in the habit of magazines, but would like to see a wider range of things. And by the way, we have, of course, a range of controversialists amongst our wide range of writers, but we've only a relatively small number of controversialists. The vast majority of our writers are nothing to do with the sort of culture wars or the identity politics, though it has helped us by driving so many people to despair.
How does the WikiLeaks column fit in with this? A writer in 2021 alleged submitting fake stories to The Spectator about Marcus Rashford, for example, that his mother wanted to nationalise all food. And she said that it went quite far down the line. What's your kind of version of events of that incident?
Yeah, I think that was a blog by a self-confessed fantasist. So I'm afraid to say we didn't recognise very much of that that blog. We get a lot of this stuff online, I think. I think what you're talking to is, I don't know, was it somebody who said they made up a name and made up a story, but then didn't have their own name or their own story and stuff. So, yeah, there's a lot of that sort of stuff going around, I'm afraid.
The other of your writers who attracts controversy sometimes is Rod Liddell, and particularly the suggestion of racism in his work. In 2010, the Press Complaints Commission upheld a complaint saying he was unable to substantiate a claim about black people and crime. What's the role of an editor with a writer like that? And where do you see this line between freedom of expression and hate speech?
Yeah, that was on a point of fact. I think he used a figure saying that the vast majority of crime was carried out by a violent crime in London was carried out by young African Caribbean men. Now, that is a factual, either that's accurate or it's not. At the time, I think Rod was unable to substantiate that, although I do from memory think that later figures did suggest that he was right. But your job in the role of editor is interesting because that's changed a lot. Now, that was, 12 years ago, wasn't it? On a blog when blogs were relatively new. Now, what happens now is anything that's published now quite controversial. Take the subject of race and crime, for example. It's an incendiary subject. It's a very important subject, especially when it comes to stop and search, when it comes to gun crime, when it comes to gang crime. It is of huge importance to find out which communities this is happening to, which communities the police should be protecting most, who suffers worse. So when you're doing this, you need to be 110% sure of your facts. Now, what we do, or what the process we've now got in line, was if we were to get an article like that for the magazine or for the blog, we've got a team of fact-checkers who would go through it and make sure every single point was correct. Now, that article you're referring to there, I think it came out a few months into my editorship where I had not set up the processes, which you now need to have controversial debates. So the role of the editor, above all, is to make sure that everything is accurate, but it is also to protect your writers from misinterpretation. Now, quite often, one of the things that you've noticed recently is that writers get right, if they write something which is taken the wrong way, like the writer Kevin Myers was fired from the Sunday Times after making a joke about, I can't remember, about Vanessa Feltz's salary and things. I mean, it was a little aside. Now, right now, you're in an environment where I call it hyper-scrutiny in the digital world. Everything you say will be taken and scrutinised, but not just by social media, but by your non-readers. And it's very important to make sure that everything is, that you identify anything controversial before it gets sent out. It's not the case that you should hide from a battle. But the writer Barry Weiss said of the New York Times that it didn't have Twitter on its masthead, but it was in effect edited by Twitter because it had come to live in fear of what Twitter says. Now, she also pointed out that if you're a writer, and a writer who worries about being ratioed by Twitter every single time that write a sentence ceases to become a writer. And I think that's a very important point, because writers do quite often get fearful of what happens, especially if they make a joke or on the side. And there was a Scottish writer a couple of weeks ago, Ian McWhirter, a brilliant columnist, who tried to make a satirical comment about conservatives, where I think he used the word coconut to describe some conservatives. In other words, it's a racial slur, I'm sure you know, like brown on the outside, white on the inside. Now, Ian McWhirter is the least racist person you can imagine. He's a fantastic columnist. He's an independent supporter, not my politics. But he still had a column suspended because as a writer, he made a flippant remark on Twitter, which he intended it to be ironic. It was taken as being serious. As a result, he was cancelled or had his column suspended. Now, the job of an editor is to protect writers from that sort of malign misinterpretation that can so often get put onto articles. And this is a relatively new form of scrutiny that writers get now. This is why I propose to my colleagues that they don't spend that much time on Twitter, because on Twitter, nobody's there to really edit what you say. So the job of an editor is to make sure, first of all, everything's correctly, all the articles are correct, the facts are correct, but also to minimise the potential for malicious misinterpretation. And that, especially if you come up with minority views like The Spectator, you are especially liable to malicious misinterpretation. So we've now become a lot better at making sure that our pieces are protected in that way, a lot better than we were even 3 years ago, let alone 12 years ago.
We're coming towards the end of our time, so a last question from me is, are there any columns or articles that you feel perhaps you didn't protect the author in that way, or that, you know, he sailed a bit close to the wind, or made a miscalculation?
Yeah, so many. It really pains me when I think about, you know, the times which I, as an editor, let writers down by just, you know, allowing a piece, you know, it might be like satire, for example, can be the most dangerous thing to do now. Because if you make a satirical point, it can be taken literally on social media, or you can get screenshotted. In other words, the rest of the sentence gets obliterated, only the offending sentence comes out, so the article is never seen. So the writer can get holed up for all sorts of things. I think about Lionel Shriver recently, I forget the comment that she made, but it was something which, you know, she got again hauled as a racist. This is, again, one of the least racist people you can think of, and a brilliant novelist as well. And, you know, she at the time was quite stoic about it. Oh, this was my words. But no, I thought to myself, I let you down there. If I'd have seen that column in that particular sentence, I might have at least said to you, Lionel, are you sure you want to say it in exactly this term? Because you know it might be misinterpreted. If you could just rephrase it slightly differently, put in a word here or a word there, that would diminish the ability of being misinterpreted. Now, right now, I think we've got a pretty good what I call red team. It's a group of three people at The Spectator, whose job it is to go through those. But before the red team came along, some of our writers were susceptible to that. And the problem now is that you so often writers can be defined by one tiny little slip, tiny little joke, and be disparaged as terrible things. I mean, in Ian McWhirter's case, a racist, right? This is a guy who's written hundreds and hundreds of columns, very, very good ones, and a long writing career in Scotland, who is now suspended on racism charges. I could be here for another hour talking about the things I wished I managed to spot and prevent. But I think we do an okay job now. But it's still, if you want to be humorous, if you want to be satirical, if you want to go against the grain, you stand a greater risk now of serious digital defamation than at any point in the past. So it's quite a risk for writers.
A couple of final questions from me. The first one is about money. So it's a rule of the podcast that we always ask about money and how it interacts with people's writing lives. So, you know, be as candid as guarded as you're comfortable, but both in your personal own career, but also as an editor, how does money work as a factor in terms of deciding what to pay people, how much people get paid? And the second question was slightly more personal, but is whether you still feel yourself to be an outsider, because that seems to have been a theme that has been a factor in your career. You alluded to it speaking to us earlier, and you now have a job that, at least from the outside, seems in many ways a kind of ultimately insider job, and how you walk that line. So yeah, those are the two final ones from me.
On money, I feel this very strongly. I am in quite a fortunate position. I've got a national column. I'm a newspaper editor. I am paid well. The writers of The Spectator, you know, the funny thing about it is that we've only got three or four staff writers. And the people who write for us occasionally, they don't tend to write for... The Spectator has never paid what you might regard as commercial rates. So people like Rod Little, Charles Murr, I don't know how much they get paid by the newspapers, probably £5,000 a column, I don't know, a lot of money. Now, obviously, we can give them absolutely nowhere near that. But people write for The Spectator primarily, not for financial reasons, but for uncommercial reasons, because they cherish the magazine's integrity, they love the project, and also they know that we simply cannot afford Fleet Street rates. So we like to... Now, if I'm doing my job, The Spectator is a sort of magazine where people will feel proud to write for it. Now, that's for people who write for us occasionally. We're talking like once or twice a year. Now, my colleagues now, for the first time, I mean, when I first became editor, I think there were, I don't know, 7 or 8 editorial staff. Now there's 35. There is a trait in writing where people are rich enough to afford the low salary, and that's a problem. So you get people whose family are helping them, sometimes topping up their monthly salary or helping them with a combination, etc. That will mean that you can work in London for 20 grand, 25 grand. These are tiny salaries. But it become quite difficult for me, even as an editor, to try to negotiate better salaries for my colleagues if the market salaries are so loose. I mean, you can go on the websites now and find out how much writers are paid, and it's very, very little. So it becomes difficult to make the case internally, as any editor has to, saying, look, I know that the market value for this person is like 30 grand, but I think they should be paid 35 grand because they're so good and they're so productive. It's difficult in any business to make that sort of argument. So, but the way I like to think of it is our writers at The Spectator are different because we're still multitasking. I mean, you can do a podcast, you can do sub-editing, you can do a whole bunch of things. So it's production as well as writing. Writing is never really paid that well as a career in this country, as any writer knows, with a handful of exceptions. But I do think that our industry, journalism, is making a big mistake in relying a bit too much, because the problem with low salaries is it's socially exclusionary. In other words, you end up with people rich enough to afford below pay. It also means you lack diversity. Journalism is a very white profession. When you look around that, you can certainly see a lack of BME representation. I work with the Social Mobility Foundation. They deal with kids who are very bright. They go on free school meals, so they're therefore from poor families, but then they get great results. And very, very few of them want to be writers. They, understandably so, if you're an immigrant family, if your parents have moved halfway around the world, you don't want to be missing about on 25 grand writing. You want to be going for a career that can reasonably get you on the path to buying your own house. So I do think that journalism is at risk of allowing itself to be dominated by a certain social class of people from comfortable backgrounds. But I also think that's changing as well. I think sub-editors are being more highly valued, and I think newspapers are beginning to change, although for a long time, typically the model of a young journalist was somebody who'd be a partner, or somebody whose partner would be a lawyer or something, so they could bring in the money and the other person could live their dream. I've been 25 years in journalism, the salaries in the profession have gone down a lot in real terms over that 25 years, and it's not a good thing. Now, your question about me being an outsider, I feel it in many ways. I guess, it sounds, of course, strange sitting in my beautiful gilded cage here of an office to in any way describe myself as an outsider. But I'm just aware that, you know, I was the first member of my family to go to university. Even finished school was quite a result. It was more than my dad did. And quite often, I'm just aware there are little cultural references that I still don't quite get. I've got imposter syndrome, as a lot of people do. And you still sort of feel... It was actually... You know, the person who really did it for me, ironically, was John Cleese, right? Great comedian. But he once did this tweet where he attacked me as a half-educated tenement Scot who had somehow managed to wangle his way editing a great national magazine. And that was, you know, people with imposter syndrome will tell you that they live in fear of the moment where somebody points a finger at you and says, caught you, you're actually not supposed to be here at all. For me, that was that moment. Because by his standards, he's right. I am half educated insofar as I imagine he meant I went to, you know, like state schools. I went to private school for a few years as well, but, you know, not quite his pedigree. Tenement Scot, guilty as charged, except we didn't have many tenements in the Highlands. But no, social class is what he meant. So I do, for a while, feel like an outsider, but I like to think that I've done everything possible in my power to make it more easy for other outsiders to at least join The Spectator, for other people without any family connections to come and to use us as a ladder into, I still think, the most charmed and greatest, the most exciting profession in the world. So I like to think that, you know, the actor Kevin Spacey, who is not fashionable to cite anymore, I once heard him give a speech where he made a very good point. He was saying that if you do well in life for whatever reason, it's incumbent upon you to send the elevator back down. In other words, do what you can in every way you can to try to help other people who are from backgrounds similar to yours to break in and to make it through as you did. I like to think I've done as much as I could reasonably expect you to do in that field.
Well, we'll leave it on that optimistic note. Thanks very much for your time and for speaking to us today. And good luck with everything going forward.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
That was the Always Take Notes interview with Fraser Nelson. He's on Twitter at Fraser Nelson, and the website of The Spectator is spectator.co.uk. Hello, it's us again. Rachel, what was your takeaway from the interview with Fraser?
Well, it was interesting to hear from him as someone overseeing another weekly publication that has a marquee print product that's making that transition into digital. I know that their podcasts and things like that are very popular. And also to hear about his rise through the ranks and also how he manages the plurality of voices in The Spectator. How about you?
I thought it was very interesting. I mean, we've now had a senior editor from The New Statesman and the top man at The Spectator. So I feel we've kind of covered two interesting and contrasting corners of the British political media. I was very interested by his own kind of progression from Scotland and this kind of question of to what extent he continues to feel an outsider, although he's someone operating at the real heart of the Westminster bubble. And I think that has been a theme that we've had on the podcast before with someone like Tina Brown as well, to what extent one needs to remain a bit external to the world you're writing about. Anyway, Rachel, what have you been up to?
I recently published, or not so recently by the time this goes out, but wrote a review of Ted Lasso. I don't know if you watch it, Simon.
I've not watched it, but I'm familiar with it. Rachel, you'll be pleased to know.
Yeah, so I wrote about its representation of the world of football, which is obviously something I'm interested in. And other than that, trying to think, not much. How about you?
I've been up in the mountains a lot. I did 12 straight days of ski touring, which was excellent, but I was absolutely exhausted when I came down yesterday. But it's been very good for the new book.
You've got the ski goggle glow.
I know. That's a visual reference that our podcast listeners cannot get, but it is correct. And I've also been trying to learn Swiss German, which is quite an undertaking. And I speak German fine and pretty fluently, but I've been having to ask people basically to speak to me in Swiss German, which is the language they speak at school and do not speak themselves. So it's been a kind of fascinating linguistic journey as well, but it's been going very well. Anyway, this has been Always Take Notes, hosted by me, Simon Akam.
And me, Rachel Lloyd.
Our producer and social media editor is Artemis Irvin. Our score is by Jess Danheiser, and our graphic design is by James Edgar.
If you'd like to follow us on social media, we're on Twitter at Take Notes Always. We're on Instagram at Always Take Notes. If you'd like to support us on our crowdfunding page on Patreon, we're on there under Always Take Notes. And if you'd like to leave a review on iTunes or get in touch with us via our website, please do.
Many thanks. Goodbye.